Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 4, Current M&A Issues in Transactions Involving Hedge Fund Managers. Cheryl Orr and Floyd Whitlin will discuss current M&A issues and trends in transactions involving hedge fund managers. Now, on to the podcast.
My name is Floyd Whitlin, and on my left is my partner, Cheryl Orr. We are both partners in the corporate and business transactions practice of Morgan Lewis, resident here in New York. And in the next 900 seconds, we're going to review M&A issues involving hedge fund managers. Hedge fund managers are often engaged on a daily basis in trading activity. The one trade they don't engage in on a daily basis, which we're going to talk about today, is the trade of the equity in their own firm. And that's really what M&A is about in this context. And one of the questions we frequently get from folks who may consider a sale of either a controlling or non-controlling stake in their firm is, well, tell me exactly how does this work? What's the timeline? What's the process, et cetera? So we're going to review that. I highly recommend if you receive a call, either directly from a prospective buyer or through an investment banker, that you yourself consider engaging an investment banker, particularly an investment banker that is experienced and skilled in the asset management industry generally and in hedge fund managers specifically. Hiring a friend of yours who's a technology banker is not going to do much good for you in these types of transactions. Why do I recommend you engage a banker? Because they do that regularly, much like you may do trading regularly. And second, based on our experience, they actually do not only add value in terms of the process, but may in fact add value in terms of the aggregate price that is paid to a hedge fund manager. So what do you do if you were to engage an investment banker? Well, you will map out with them. Are you going to have a very narrow search? It could be so narrow as to merely engage with a single potential buyer who may have approached you. Even if a single potential buyer has approached you, might you consider expanding the potential field of buyers? And that could be either a relatively small, limited search or a broader search. The banker may then assist you in the preparation of a confidential information memorandum, which would be sent to the prospective buyers who you select. And then those buyers, in connection with the receipt of information from you, would enter into a non-disclosure agreement. If you've not already done so at that time, you may consider hiring counsel, which could be your regular hedge fund counsel, but probably should be somebody who specializes in M&A in this field. One of the things the banker will do for you early in the process will help you to organize the electronic data site, which is all of the information that a prospective buyer would be interested in about your company. That is all the information that they could be presented in a documentary basis in an electronic data site. In addition, of course, a buyer will want to spend a lot of time talking with the individual principals of the hedge fund manager. The information that will be in the data room would include not only business and legal information, but financial information as well. So once you, if you go through a process in which there are potentially multiple bidders, you'll select a winning bidder, followed by an execution of a term sheet, which may include a grant to that bidder of exclusivity. After that, you'll be on a two-prong process, continuing the due diligence effort if you are the buyer, as well as the preparation and negotiation of definitive documents for the purchase of the interest. Now, it could be, as I said before, a controlling or non-controlling interest in the firm. Now, what you will then do is potentially, it's something to consider, before you actually execute a definitive purchase agreement, you may want to give some of your key investors in your funds a heads up as to you're about to, perhaps, or someone, perhaps the buyer, is about to announce the acquisition, as I said, of either a controlling or non-controlling interest in your firm. Once you execute the definitive agreement, you will probably amend your ADV to reflect that as a material transaction, such to update your ADV. What do you do post-signing and prior to the closing of the transaction? Cheryl will speak to, you'll address the client consent issue, and to the extent there are any regulatory approvals which might be acquired, such as a Hart-Scott-Rodino antitrust filing, you'll deal with those in the interim. Then you will get to the closing of the transaction, and there are certain items which need to be considered after you close the transaction. The transaction may be structured such that there are purchase price adjustments, which could depend upon things such as working capital. It could depend upon how you have done in terms of obtaining your client consents. There also could be an earn-out component, which will be something which will incentivize you in order to achieve results for the buyer going forward, and you'll get paid for that. And then you may post-closing need to deal with indemnification claims. Cheryl?
Good morning. Client consents are a very important piece of any M&A transaction, internal reorg, or other similar corporate transaction involving a hedge fund. The question of whether client consents will be needed should be raised and considered early on in the transaction timeline to make sure that the right actions are taken and that you allow enough time in the timeline to obtain the consents that are needed to be obtained. The consent requirements in the context of an investment advisory agreement is both a statutory and contractual interpretation question. As a result, determining whether client consents are required for a given transaction is not as straightforward as it may be in other contexts. In determining whether client consents are required, the first question is, does the advisory contract to be assigned require consent? If the answer is yes, which should be the case because it's always required by applicable law, as I'll talk about in a moment, you would need to get consent from the counterparty to the advisory contract. If the answer is no, then you need to look at the applicable statutes and guidance to determine whether consent is needed. Section 205A of the Investment Advisors Act states that every investment advisory contract must provide in substance that no assignment of such contract may be made by the investment advisor without the consent of the other party. In other words, regardless of whether the investment advisory contract requires consent for assignment or is silent with respect to assignment, consent will be required in order for the investment advisor to be able to assign that contract. This leads us to the next question. Is the transaction being undertaken an assignment? Under Section 202A1 of the Investment Advisors Act, an assignment includes any direct or indirect transfer of an investment advisory contract or of a controlling block of the assignor's outstanding voting securities by a security holder of the assignor. Pursuant to both Rule 202A11 of the Investment Advisors Act and Rule 2A6 of the Investment Company Act, a transaction that does not result in a change of actual control or management of an investment advisor is not an assignment. So what is a controlling block or actual control? A controlling block of voting securities is not defined in the Investment Advisors Act, but pursuant to the Form ADV instructions, a person is presumed to control, one, a corporation, if it has the right to vote or sell 25% or more of a class of the corporation's voting securities. Two, a partnership, if it has the right to receive upon dissolution or has contributed to 25% or more of the capital of the partnership. Or three, a limited liability company, if it has the right to vote 25% or more of a class of the interests of the limited liability company, or it is a manager of the limited liability company. Under Section 2A9 of the Investment Company Act, any person who owns beneficially more than 25% of the voting securities of a company is presumed to control such company. Therefore, if we boil all this down, if there is a true assignment, meaning that the actual advisory contract is being assigned, or if one or more persons who do not currently own equity in the investment advisor acquire 25% or more of the equity of the investment advisor, then the consent of the counterparty to the advisory contract will be required. When the counterparty to an investment advisory agreement is the fund, the consent of the fund's investors or shareholders may also be needed. This consent can take various forms. It could be positive consent, either by written consent of the investors or shareholders or through an investor or shareholder vote, depending on the size and the type of the fund. Based on some no-action letters, it could also be by negative consent, where you give notice to the investors, typically at least twice, telling them of the transaction and letting them know that if they don't respond, their consent will be deemed to have been given. Or it could also be a special redemption right or some other type of vote. In a transaction context, what are the practical implications of failing to obtain all of the client consents? As you can imagine, given the desire to maximize AUM post-closing, obtaining client consents is going to be very important for your buyer. And so the buyer is going to want to impose contractual penalties on the seller if it fails to obtain the client consents. The number of client consents that will need to be obtained will be a deal point that will be negotiated as part of the transaction. From the buyer's perspective, you want to obtain, if not all of the client consents, then at least those that are going to maximize the post-closing AUM to the fullest extent possible. From the seller's perspective, if the seller has an earnout, its goals will be aligned with the buyer on that front, but its interest will also be deal certainty. It wants to make sure that if it doesn't get a few consents, the deal will still close. Often a deal will be struck between the buyer and the seller that require the seller to obtain, either as a condition to closing or as a purchase price adjustment, the consent of those clients that represent a minimum threshold of AUM. From a deal certainty point, a seller is going to want to prefer to have it as a purchase price adjustment rather than a closing condition.
If you're a buyer, you want to, because the hedge fund manager is a talent-ridden industry, and it's all about acquiring the talent, what you need to do is you really need to incentivize, from the buyer's perspective, you need to incentivize the principal and the key people at the hedge fund manager to remain not only with the hedge fund manager, but to remain motivated following a transaction. So once again, you need to distinguish between a transaction in which a buyer is acquiring the entire ownership of the hedge fund manager, as opposed to a situation where the buyer is acquiring less than 100% of the hedge fund manager. In the latter case, it's likely that the hedge fund manager, because of its retained ownership stake, or the principles of the hedge fund manager, will be very much invested in the continued performance and success of the business. In any event, both in a control sale and a non-control sale, the buyer will want to assure that the hedge fund manager retains his or her motivation by imposing really two important requirements. Number one, there's the carrot approach. And the carrot approach is, as we've discussed earlier, perhaps an earnout as part of the transaction consideration. There also could be puts and calls with respect to some remaining equity that's owned by the hedge fund manager, such the hedge fund manager maximizes the value it receives based upon the performance of the company going forward. The other is the stick approach. One of the stick approaches in all of these deals, and maybe it's not properly characterized as a stick, is to the extent proceeds are paid to the principals of the hedge fund manager in this transaction, the buyer would request or insist that a large portion perhaps of those proceeds be reinvested into the fund, which is managed by the principals of the hedge fund manager. The other stick is a non-compete and non-solicit provision. And what the non-compete does, as it is clear, restricts the principal of the hedge fund manager from competing with the business that the buyer acquired. The last thing that the buyer wants to do is to have egg on its face as a result of its paying a lot of money to acquire this asset and then having the talent, which goes up and down the elevator every day, no longer be with the firm. So it's going to seek to restrict that buyer from competing in the business. It's going to restrict the principal from competing in the business. It's going to restrict the principal from soliciting the investors for some other venture. And it's going to restrict the principal from soliciting or hiring the other employees of the hedge fund management firm for a specific period of time. Most people think in terms of non-compete and non-solicit restricted periods in the context of an employment relationship. This is a bit different. In an employment relationship, there may be zero non-compete. There may be some non-solicit. But in the sale of a business or in the sale of a control or non-control position in a business, the duration of those non-competes are considerably longer, somewhere between 3 and up to 10 years in certain cases. The one thing I want to close with is this. If you are buying a hedge fund manager located in California, throw all of this out, particularly if you're buying less than 100% of the hedge fund manager in California. So we're out of time. Thanks so much.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan, Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan, Lewis & its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.